Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Today, as every week, at least since the middle of November, you have Mark Hamilton and you have Mr. Mark Daly, the longtime host, creator, and I've also heard the term overlord in reference to your functional and practical role with this show. But it's the middle of January. We're creeping towards the beginning of a season. You know, we saw an amazing and peaceful transition of power in the United States this week, which always feels good to see, regardless of which political side you're on.
Yeah.
But you know what? I feel like we're slowly creeping closer and closer to the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we're seeing vaccinations successfully deployed globally. You're hearing great news stories out of certain countries where they're starting to really tackle the situation and vaccinate the bigger portion of the population. But I'm excited. And you know, I think we have reason to be. We know, and we talked about this last week, that the Australian Grand Prix, which was teed up to be the season opener, has been pushed off until the fall. That's fine. It makes sense. But still, we have Bahrain, and it's only, at this point, maybe 8 weeks away, 60 days. And between then and now, we also get to see all of the introductions to the 2021 challengers. And some of these teams have already started posting teasers. They've started posting their dates. There's lots to be excited about. My friend, how are you doing?
Well, I'm still stinging a little bit from that overlord comment. I mean, are you hinting I'm a little bit overbearing? I mean, I try to be as well. Anyways, let's move past that. But yes, there is a lot to look forward to. You know, and I specifically love this time of year when you just pick up your phone, you start scrolling through the news, and you see the announcement: Ferrari's going to launch their car on this date, Mercedes on this date, and Red Bull on this day. And then, like you say, you get these like little teasers. You know, like a hint of a paint scheme or maybe a piece of bodywork or something like that. And then you see things like, you know, like Carlos Sainz, his first test, the first time he's going to get in the Ferrari, he's going to be on such and such a day. You know, all these stories, you know, it gets pretty exciting. You know, when you start to build up like this, despite the fact that the season is going to be delayed for a couple of weeks with the rescheduling and juggling around of Melbourne. But hey, that's just the world that we're living in the moment. And like you were saying just now, yeah, there's still a lot of bad news out there, but there are some rays of sunshine poking through all the doom and gloom. And I think slowly but surely that that things will start to get better. And like you say, the inauguration of Joe Biden the other day, and regardless of your political leanings, whatever your beliefs are, Democrat, Republican, I just hope that together that the country can move forward and just in a new sense of cooperation. And hopefully a lot of these, you know, bad feelings have been put behind us. I mean, there certainly is a lot more we can achieve together. And hopefully, 2021 turns out to be much better than 2020. Because I had one, you know, our good friend Victor Sum, you know, I saw him tweet on, I think it was just after New Year's. It's like, guys, don't be too excited about 2021. Because if you look at it, you break it down, it's 2020 WON. And I'm like, ooh, that's a little bit too heavy, my friend.
Yeah, but shout out to our boy Victor, a huge local football fan and Whitecaps supporter. Somebody I think that both of us have known for quite a while.
Yep.
There is a little bit of bad news. And, you know, I've refrained so hard from bringing this up over the last couple of months with you. But as everybody knows, I'm a gigantic OVO fan, a gigantic Drake fan. His album, which was expected to be dropped in January, has been delayed. I am emotionally devastated. So if I'm a little bit off today, that's why. It's not because Mark did anything or gave me some feedback about my performance. It's just I was expecting that to kind of break up the winter blues, and it's not going to happen. So that aside, I think we could probably jump right into it, right?
Yeah, well, where do we want to start? I mean, again, it's been a bit of a strange off season so far. I mean, we finished the year 2020 as later than usual, what with the season finale in Abu Dhabi, but there seems to be an unusual amount of news kind of, you know, really percolating up. Well, it's not even percolating; it's just out there, like each and every day. There's something quite newsworthy, especially in a time of year that is usually pretty flat and pretty devoid of news, because most of the drivers, they're just coming back from their break, they're starting to condition, you know, back at the factories, they're getting ready, and you know, they're rushing to get the cars ready for the season, getting ready to go to Barcelona for, you know, as traditionally we've done for many years, for winter testing and all the car launches and all that. But there is a lot of other stories just out there, and it makes it interesting. Don't get me wrong, I mean, it certainly gives us plenty to talk about on this this show, but it is it's really, really good. The one story that immediately caught my my eye off the top here was Stefano Domenicali saying that he heard from Lewis Hamilton that that Lewis is undecided at the moment whether or not he's going to sign a new deal with Mercedes. Domenicali told Sky Sports 24 that he spoke to Lewis over the Christmas break. He said that he's preparing for the new season, but he remained very non-committal on whether or not he's going to sign a new deal with the Silver Arrows. But, you know, I think as eye-popping and attention-grabbing as that headline is, I really expect that this deal is going to get done. I just, at this point, I think there's still too much for Lewis to play for. I think that he wants to set the records. I think he still wants to, you know, seal his legacy as the GOAT outright. I mean, he's right up there with Schumacher in terms of championships and all the records he holds. So I don't know. I think that maybe this is a little more clickbaity than anything, but it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on that one, Mark.
You know, it's funny. I think my reaction to the story, and I saw it come across my feed as well earlier today, is it's less about the substance of the conversation, but more about who's answering the question. Like I was a little bit thrown that F1 boss Stefano Domenicali is commenting on an out of contract racer with the sport's preeminent squad. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt very Bernie to me. Like Bernie always had an opinion. And if you were a reporter and you had access to Bernie, he was a great person to go to get a quote. But I find it interesting that he's weighing in on this subject. And if I'm Lewis's camp and if I'm the Mercedes team, do I need him creating a distraction and commenting on kind of an internal contractual matter? I thought that was kind of interesting. And I agree. Like if we're going to comment purely on the contract matter at hand, I think it's going to happen. I don't think it was particularly helpful that George Russell had that opportunity to drive Lewis's car in Bahrain. Whether that ultimately means that Lewis is going to sign for less money or not, I don't know. But I think ultimately he could potentially have lost leverage in that negotiation. But ultimately, I'm supremely confident he's going to be back. And I've seen the stories and I've seen the speculation online that he would be happy to hang it up. I don't believe for a second that somebody that's worked as long and as hard as he did would be willing to compromise the opportunity to leave the sport with the greatest number of WDCs that anyone's ever achieved. Like, I think he's all in, but I think he has certain expectations around what this contract's going to look like. And I think he wants to be able to dictate term and value. And I think ultimately that's what's going to happen. And it's also widely speculated as well that the contract's done and Mercedes just isn't ready to announce it. But to your point, it's going to happen, whether it's now or next week or next month. It would be possibly the greatest shock in Formula One history if the reigning world champion didn't return to this team, because he wouldn't have an alternative seat in the sport.
Yeah, it just logically it makes no sense. And to your point that the deal's been done and Mercedes isn't, you know, they just haven't announced it yet. That would be, I think we've seen signs of that, because I mean, Valtteri Bottas mentioned it last year when, you know, he'd said that a contract was all but done for another, you know, I guess, you know, we all speculated at the time it'd be another 1 year deal. And it took a couple of weeks before that one was announced. But again, it would make no sense for him not to sign this contract, because right now, Lewis has to be at his peak value. 7-time world champion. He's still dominant in the sport. I mean, as impressive as George Russell was in that that one-off at Bahrain 2 for the Sakhir Grand Prix, that it was only a weekend. And of course, you know, if there's any driver that's under threat in that team, it would more likely be Bottas than Hamilton himself. And I just can't see him walking away, and I just can't see him, you know, giving them the hometown discount at this point, when I think his value, what he could ask and command as a salary and term and value of the contract, just as exactly as you said, I think it's absolute peak right now. And I think that it'll be announced at some point. I mean, it would be nothing short of completely earth-shattering for Lewis not to sign this deal at this point. I just can't see any reason for it not to happen.
I say we make a pact that we don't address the Lewis contract situation again until he's either signed or publicly acknowledged that he's not going to sign. And I think I would, as a final nail in this coffin of the Lewis Hamilton contract discussion, I would just say that Even if you knew that George Russell could come in, replace Hamilton this season, and win the driver's title, he is less valuable to Mercedes from a marketing perspective. He is less valuable when you go to your sponsors and try to extract as much value from them as you can. Mm-hmm. Lewis has immense value that George Russell does not have now. So all things being equal, even if you knew he could win the title, he's not as valuable to that team.
Not yet. I mean, Russell's still a young guy, still very much trying to establish himself in the sport. I mean, he's got to serve his time as a number two in a big team. I mean, he might have some legitimate reason to say he's got the number one seat at a team like Williams. But I mean, if he was to move to one of the the big dogs in the sport, he would definitely have to serve some time there in an apprenticeship to a driver like Lewis Hamilton or Max Verstappen or whoever, depending where he ended up. I mean, obviously he's hoping for one of the silver cars, but that remains to be seen. Anyway, sticking with Stefano Domenicali, he said that that he and Formula One are taking what he calls a flexible approach to the 2021 calendar. We talked about it just a little bit earlier about the shift and the fact that Australia is going to be postponed till the end of the season. I think it works just from the point of view that they're going from basically different ends of the spectrum when it comes to the seasons in the Southern Hemisphere. So the dates work. Chinese Grand Prix is currently off the calendar. So, I think it makes sense that they have to be flexible like that. And I think that, Domenicali, I think he's just, I think he's just being realistic. And, for lack of a better term, I mean, he's keeping it real. I think they just, they're being very, very, I would not only just say ambitious, but pretty aggressive to try and get a 23 race season in the midst of an ongoing pandemic. And very much, I think that there will still be some changes along the way. Hopefully not too many, because it would be great to get all those races in. 17, like I said, the week or so ago, felt like a really hefty season, considering we'd get started till July last year. But I'm ready to go. I'm ready to start like right now if we could, but it's not up to me.
This is one of those things that I want to see him commenting on. And yes, I also respect the fact that he's willing to compromise early. And surely from Liberty's perspective, that they accounted for these kind of adjustments when they were building that calendar. It's nice to see that they've been so, and fortunately they haven't really had to be reactive. They built some flexibility into the calendar. I'm not particularly sad to see China off the calendar for 2021. I'm significantly more excited to see Imola and Portugal once again. So I think they're going to be good. And, again, we talked about this before. If you look at the first half of the schedule, they built it in such a way that, with the exception maybe of Monaco, Azerbaijan, and Canada, these are really tracks that can host races that aren't dependent on access to a metro core. So I think the calendar was constructed in such a way that there's some flexibility that they can adjust on the fly if they need to. And again, like you said, I'm super excited to see what this calendar holds. And just like last year, we're going to be racing up till really a week before, 2 weeks before Christmas, which mm-hmm. Which is just crazy.
It is, but I've really come to embrace these super long seasons, that as the calendar's slowly grown over the years. I mean, when you kind of go back and you look at what the World Championship was like in the 1950s, where it was like eight races or six races a year, whatever it was.
Right, right.
I'm thinking, if I traveled back in time, I could not handle that. The six race, I mean, obviously the world in 1950 from a logistics and sporting point of view was very different. But still, the fact that there just wasn't TV or internet, I wouldn't have been able to cope. But you transplant me from 2021 to 1950, completely different world. I'll do it the other way around, might blow some minds as well. But the one thing that I find very interesting, and I mean we've been speculating it about how the season might change quite a bit over the past couple of weeks, but the organizers for the Monaco Grand Prix are pretty insistent that their Formula One, Formula E and the historic Grand Prix events are still going to go ahead 100% as planned, despite the ongoing issues and concerns and everything going on around the ongoing pandemic situation. So they, the Automobile Club de Monaco responded to news and rumors and ongoing speculation out there that perhaps the whole thing that's scheduled for the weekend of May 23rd would be blown off like it was last year. I mean, we basically lost pretty much much a third of the season right off the bat there before they start rescheduling and putting everything together. So, I mean, obviously, like we said, Azerbaijan, that's in question. Canada's in question. So I just, the one thing I find interesting about it is one of these races that's actually in an urban setting, as urban as Monte Carlo is. I find it interesting that in an area where there are basically a residential area that this one is still going on, according to the organizers, as of this date and time right now. So certainly one to keep your eye on moving ahead.
I don't have a lot to add to that other than I'm shocked a little bit. And things can obviously change, but they haven't officially started selling tickets yet for this race, which I thought was a little bit interesting. I did a little bit of research too, because I wanted to understand how long the build takes to get the track ready in Monaco, and it's 6 weeks. So really, they have another month, maybe 2 months, in which case they can make the decision of whether they need to abandon the race or not. But I also appreciate that this event is very much the jewel by which the entire city markets itself, and I can appreciate how important it is. And again, that the local population is relatively small, and maybe governments and health authorities feel that, hey, you know what, maybe what we can do for this event is continue to restrict international travel, and we'll make tickets available to locals, and, you know, we'll have certain standards around vaccination rates and things like that. So there could be all kinds of things happening with the local health authorities that make them feel comfortable doing this. I still suspect Baku will probably happen as well. Again, that's a country that it's not a particularly strong liberal democracy. And I think ultimately in Baku, if the government wants the race to go ahead, the race is going to go ahead. And I think Canada's a little bit different. And I think that race is still very much at risk. But yeah, it was interesting to see the Monaco race organizers feel that they needed to come out and address those concerns. So we'll see. But they still have some time before they have to start lifting some concrete barriers and catch fencing into place.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing about Baku as well is, you know, the whole government, situation and, perhaps methods and tactics aside, is the fact that even though it's a fairly long and a fairly big circuit, I don't believe that the actual amount of spectators that they put around the circuit is all that much. I think it's, what, maybe 10, 15,000 at the absolute max. So, I mean, it wouldn't be a huge loss in terms of having people showing up at the gates. I mean, they could probably run this one behind closed doors, 100%. If you want to call it that, if they decided we want this to go ahead, but, you know, we're not going to have any spectators coming in, say, from you know, outside of Azerbaijan, and just keep it to locals. Because, I mean, most of the people that are going to watch it, I mean, they can just, if they live downtown, they can just look out their windows anyway. So those are definitely going to be ones to watch. Montreal is a completely different one. So I still think there's going to be some fluidity and changes to this first front portion of the schedule anyways. But some good COVID news now. Lando Norris, the McLaren driver, he's headed back to England after his quarantine period in Abu Dhabi. He quarantined in his hotel after returning a positive test about 2 weeks ago. He reported was a loss of smell and taste and some minor symptoms. He reported feeling a little bit under the weather now. So now he has to test negative again before he can fly home to the UK. Then he's going to isolate close to the factory in Woking, and apparently he's only going to head into, I still love it, when they say Formula One, when they call it work, you know, I'm using the inverted commas here, you know, for those of you watching on YouTube or listening on the podcast, you're not going to be able to see that anyways, I guess it is a job. For me and you, it's we probably do it for free given the opportunity, but good to hear that that Lando's feeling better. He's produced at least one negative test, and glad to hear that he'll be heading home very soon. Now, this one, I felt a little bit kind of mixed in this one. And this is Checo Perez saying that he felt he was the stupidest guy on earth last year when he was the first guy or the first driver in the Formula One paddock to actually catch COVID, and he missed a couple of races because of that, the British Grand Prix at the 70th anniversary Grand Prix at Silverstone. And I don't know. I know there was a bit of criticism because he went back to Mexico to visit with his mother, and it's a tough thing. I mean, I guess for him, he sees it a little bit differently. But I didn't actually feel, I don't want to say aggrieved or whatever it is with Sergio Perez, because I don't feel like this is something you can really, I mean, if you're going to get it, you're going to get it, just considering how contagious it was. So I thought he was being a little bit harsh on himself.
I remember in the summer, there was a story that was printed on ESPN.com that talked about Sergio's reaction to the reaction to him having caught COVID. And I think at the time, maybe it was because he was the first driver, and maybe it was because there was this whole perception that the drivers would be isolated in a bubble. And I don't think a lot of people knew that he'd left the biosphere that was the Formula One circuit and flew to Mexico. And if you do remember at that time, Mexico was going through an unprecedented surge.
Yes.
The virus was very much out of control. And I think the story broke that he had COVID before it broke that he'd gone to Mexico. So people had to kind of reverse engineer the story. And I think when they found out what had happened, that why would you go to Mexico now? Like, the globe knows it's a very problematic place in terms of infection rate and all those kind of things, that there was a lot of criticism of him. And I think it snowballed a bit. And I remember in the summer, and he was quoted in that ESPN story speaking to how angry he was. But that said, I don't doubt that he probably was a little bit embarrassed about the circumstance as well. And you're right. You know what? He could have stayed in the Formula One biosphere and still caught COVID. But I think he was right maybe to feel a little bit embarrassed. Maybe not right to feel it, but I can appreciate why he would have. But I thought it was an interesting kind of reflection from him. And you're right. At the time as well, it was that it happened, and it was that he missed multiple races because you were going into a doubleheader at Silverstone. And then it was also that Racing Point themselves were playing a little bit fast and loose with their interpretations of British health guidelines in terms of getting him back into the paddock, which created a little bit of controversy. But yeah, I thought that was an interesting story. I thought it was a nice reflection, and I liked the humility from him. Felt a little bit bad afterwards because, yeah, you know what? Being the first driver and one of the first people in the paddock that actually caught COVID, you know what? I can kind of sympathize with them. But yeah, I thought it was an interesting story.
Absolutely. Anyways, we're going to take a quick break here. And on the other side, we're going to talk a little bit more about Sergio Perez, but this time in the Red Bull context. So you want to stick around for that. So don't go away. We'll be back after this very short message from our sponsors.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the podcast. It is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton, breaking down the latest Formula One news. And before the break, Mark, we were talking about Sergio Perez feeling, you know, pretty remorseful about the fact that he caught COVID-19 last summer. But anyway, so I think we can draw a line now underneath the Sergio Perez Racing Point story and start talking about him in the context of Red Bull. And this is interesting. He says that he's already ready. Well, he's obviously already working with the team, and he thinks that he can really help the team make a step forward this year. And I wouldn't be surprised of that, because I thought that he was always had a lot of input. I think he had a lot of say in what he did at Racing Point. And I think from that point of view, I think he's a very immersed driver, and I think that he's somebody that really enjoys or really gets. Likes being a part of the process to help and develop a car, and all the great drivers and all good drivers really, really do that. And the one thing I think too that is really interesting about Sergio Perez is he's going to bring a completely fresh perspective to Red Bull. I mean, he's a guy with experience. He's a guy that's coming in completely outside of that Red Bull funnel, you know, from their, you know, through their own drivers. I mean, it is you know, completely unique in the fact that they're bringing a guy in to the system like Sergio Perez, and I'm really interested to see what effect Sergio Perez is going to have and how he's going to influence this team this year and potentially beyond.
One of the things that I don't think we probably talk enough about kind of in F1 media circles is the value that a driver provides, not so much in terms of driving the car, but the feedback that he provides to the engineers and in turn the mechanics about the setup of the car. And I think Perez's experience is such that he's historically been able to provide very good feedback to his engineers, which have enabled them to get every ounce of performance out of the cars that he's been driving. And I think perhaps one of the underreported stories about Alexander Albon's experience with Red Bull is he was a young driver, which means that he literally didn't have a lot of experience in an F1 car with F1 grip, with F1 tires on F1 tracks. But he also wasn't in a position where he could effectively articulate feedback about the dynamics of the racing experience to his engineers in such a way that they could modify the car to make it better for him. I think the great thing about Sergio is he's going to be able to step into that car and immediately provide really tangible setup feedback to the engineers so that they can quickly and seamlessly adapt that vehicle to him. And I know one of the stories that you're referring to speaks also to the fact that the real benefit here is they're going to start preseason testing, winter testing in Bahrain, and then they're immediately going to go into racing there. So he's got this really good chunk of time where he can get familiar with the car, work on the setup with the engineers, and then get a race weekend. Like, everything's kind of set up appropriately here. But I think the real value, especially for somebody like Sergio, is the value he can provide to the team in terms of feedback about the car. And no shot or criticism of Alexander Albon. He just didn't have the experience that he was effectively able to articulate his experiences in the cockpit to the engineers in the way that somebody like Sergio Perez will be able to.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, Red Bull. I mean, I think they finished the season on a fairly strong note, and the fact that the cars are really not going to be, well, I mean, there are going to be developments to it, but it's not going to be like a fresh slate like we're usually going to see, because we're kind of in this weird transition year between 2020 and the new cars that are coming out in 2022. So the one thing that I'm wondering is whether or not this is going to have any effect on the bit of the slow start that we sometimes see from Red Bull. And that's why I thought it was so interesting last year, because you know, lockdown and factory shutdowns and everything apart, Christian Horner said at one point that this was the most prepared that they'd been for a season since something like 2013 or 2012 or something like that. So basically the first time that they were ready to challenge in, you know, right from the get-go in more than half a decade. So I was really quite buoyant and really expecting a lot more. And that's the thing, is that Mercedes being the team that they are, is that they're not going to slip up too many times in the season. You know that there's not going to be too many DNFs. Those are far and few between, like we saw in Austria a couple of years ago, or, you know, in 2016 when Rosberg and Hamilton crashed on the opening lap, and, you know, various other times. I mean, those were completely different things. But the thing is that if you let them get away too quickly, that even if you start building up ahead of steam later on in the season, it's too much of a gap. I mean, it's virtually impossible to catch these guys. So they need to come out strong. They need to be going at it right from the beginning. And they got a great pairing of drivers now in Max Verstappen. You got the experienced journeyman in Sergio Perez. That's going to bring a lot of other things to the team. You know, you've got a good car. You know, you've got a pretty good engine now. If any year, if at any time recently that they're going to be able to mount a challenge, you would think, at least on paper, 2021 is, you know, you have to think they've got a legit shot at it.
Yeah, and the reality too is that the team they're going to be chasing is going to be Mercedes, and Mercedes is historically a dominant team at the beginning of every season. Remember, yep. Nico Rosberg ran off four straight wins to start the season in 2016, and obviously we all recall the epic start to the season that we saw with Mercedes in 2019. If they want to be competitive, I think they need to put Mercedes in a position that they've not been in since 2013, which is they need to be on the back foot. And yeah, they need to be on the back foot. And the only way that can happen is if Red Bull has a really strong start. And if Red Bull doesn't have a strong start, like you said, it's too late because they're not going to be able to make up that ground. But if they have a strong start and they are able to put some points on the board, then you know what, anything possibly is possible. But I think you make a great point that ultimately, if they want to be competitive this season and they want to potentially chase a constructors title, the only way that happens is that they start winning races right from the start of the season.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And I think Ferrari is the perfect comparison to make because they had a legit shot at both world championships in 2018. That last third of the season, by the, you know, after the Italian Grand Prix in Singapore, it pretty much went up in a puff of smoke thereafter. But I mean, two thirds of the way through the season, definitely up until after the summer break, they were looking pretty good. Vettel in the drivers' championship, they were looking good in the constructors' championship, but they started to slip up. And, you know, that was the thing, is they had their issues and Mercedes kept doing what they always do. They opened up a gap. Lewis opened up a gap in the championship. And at that point, it was just too late. So apparently now, just to sticking with Red Bull, apparently they have a deal in place with Honda to take over the intellectual property for their engine program. And a decision is going to be coming down from the FIA within the next couple or several days, possibly, hopefully within the next week, regarding the engine freeze decision. And honestly, Mark, I think that from a regulator point of view, from the sports point of view as a whole, I think that you need to make this happen. And I think it's kind of interesting too that that some, I don't want to say protest, but some of the things, some of the words that were being, you know, sort of voiced in opposition to the whole engine freeze thing that were coming from Ferrari. I mean, guys, really? You, and I mean, this whole secret deal that they had with the FAA just over a year ago with their power unit, it still bugs me. It still gets under my skin because they were obviously up to something. For them to kind of stick in there, and regardless if it's a rival or not, I think that they have to find a way, not Ferrari, but the FAA and Formula One have to find a way to make this thing happen. Otherwise, Red Bull are in a pretty, pretty tough spot. I mean, they're not going to get Mercedes engines. Renault, maybe. Ferrari, probably not. I mean, where else are they going to get you know, their power units from? So I think from my point of view, it needs to happen.
100%, it has to happen. And there's a lot of reasons beyond what's on the paper in front of us in terms of reporting on this story. I think that the bigger concern for the FIA in Liberty is there's no guarantee that Mercedes will continue to produce power units well into the future. There's no guarantee that Renault will continue to produce power units well into the future. You can't afford to lose another engine supplier. And if there's an opportunity for Red Bull to become an engine producer and potentially an engine supplier to feed teams in the future, you need to do whatever it takes to nurture that development. And to your point as well, if you spoke to any one of these teams, and I strongly believe Mercedes included, that an engine freeze, given the financial uncertainty of the sport, given what we've experienced the last 12 months in terms of the COVID piece and in terms of introducing financial stability to the sport, like an engine freeze makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Allowing I guess not even allowing, but enabling Red Bull to be in a position where they can make that investment in the Honda IP so they can become an engine producer and potentially an engine supplier. These are all good things for the sport. The one thing I'm really curious about is I'm dying to understand, and Mark, who speaks to the fact that the deal with Honda is all but done, it's really just pending whether the sport's going to look at kind of implementing this engine freeze, but I'm dying to understand the financial aspects of that deal, right? Like, I don't think when Honda backed out of the sport, they did so thinking that, hey, we can spin off our engine IP and make money off it. Like, I can't help but wonder if they've basically gifted it to Red Bull as a parting gift. So I'm dying to see what the terms of the deal were when they are finally disclosed, if they're ever disclosed. But I'm super, super curious to understand what that looked like, because ultimately the engine IP is worthless. You can't sell it off to anyone else. There's no one on the market looking for F1 IP. And even if there was, it would take years and hundreds of millions of dollars to build a car that kind of accommodates that engine. So I'm really, really curious to see. But I'm also excited to see Red Bull, in a sense, become something of a works manufacturer for the first time, right? Ever since their inception, you know, they've obviously had the Renault partnership, and their sister team Toro Rosso was temporarily partnered with Ferrari. But I'm really curious to see what this team can do when they're fully integrated. And they had a great relationship with Honda, as short-lived as it was. They had a terrible relationship with Renault, and they made that work from a championship perspective. But I'm super pumped to see what they can do as really an integrated works team.
Yeah, you know, and it's you make some great points there, and I think, you know, if you're Red Bull, even though it you know, it's obviously not an ideal situation to be in when your engine supplier comes in and kind of pulls the carpet out from underneath you, but in terms of wanting to take that operation over, now is almost the ideal time, as long as you can come to financial agreement with them, because this is not the Honda power unit of 2015. I mean, this thing has a lot of miles on it. It's got a lot of development in it, and we've seen the improvement. We know that that they're going to design a good chassis around it. So I mean, I think that the foundations of something very potentially very successful is there. It's very tantalizing. And I just see from the broader perspective of Formula One, I just see too many pluses for this thing happening rather to say, the engine freeze, bad idea. Like you said, I mean, bring the cost down, which is something they've been trying to do anyways, especially inside this COVID environment where revenues are down everywhere, that it makes too much sense. And much like you, I would love to see what these guys could do as an outright works manufacturer in their own right. And it'd be kind of interesting too. I was thinking about it this afternoon. It's just, Red Bull are always on point when it comes to savvy marketing and things like that. I just wondered what they would, if they have their own engine, would they brand it as a Red Bull, or would it be something something else? Would they go back to like the Tag Heuer branded Renault engines, or would they? I'm sure they could come up with something pretty slick if they wanted to.
And the one thing I'll add as well, because I think some of the listeners might be wondering, like, why is this Honda IP deal contingent on a kind of an engine freeze? That the reality is this is. Red Bull's going to spend, or maybe not spend, but they're going to invest in the Honda IP, and they're going to take on the risk of continuing the development of that engine. If Formula One was to flip the script and introduce a new engine formula, that existing Honda IP is worthless, because it's based on the current 1.6 liter turbo hybrid spec. And if the sport was to change the engine formula, that becomes worthless. So the reason why Red Bull is so invested in this engine freeze is, as long as there's an engine freeze, there's value in buying that IP and integrating it into their workflow and continuing to invest in it. But if the sport is ultimately leaning towards a new engine formula, whether it's a simplified V8 or it's further electrification, that Honda IP is worthless, completely worthless, and it would be cheaper and more efficient to buy a power unit from a different manufacturer. So that's kind of why they're so invested in this engine freeze. But I am too, because it just introduces cost certainty to the sport at a time when it desperately needs it.
Yeah. You know, you stole the words right out of my mouth in the latter part of your reply to me there. So I have nothing to add to that. I mean, other than the fact that right now that, like you say, I mean, it would make no sense to like completely change the formula and design of these engines when they're looking to new engine regs in 2026. Sure, that's 5 years down the road. But considering that, you know, we're going to be in a global economic slump or crunch or whatever it is, for, you know, probably quite a while after, you know, COVID, you know, post-COVID, right? So it just does not make sense, especially over the past decade, that hundreds of millions or billions of dollars collectively have been spent to develop these engines. I personally think it's time to cool it. I think it works. I think that they're fantastic pieces of technology. I mean, if they can tweak the designs here or there, you know, maybe experiment with the biofuels or whatever, sure, I guess there's some room to play around with it, but I don't think that they should flip it upside down. I think the freeze is the perfect way to go at this point in time. Anyways, Mark, let's take another quick break here on the show. And when we come back, let's talk about Alpine for a little bit here on the flip side. And we'll do that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right. Well, welcome back. So let's turn it around here and go in a little bit of a different direction. So Esteban Ocon says that he believes that the Alpine F1 team is in good hands, as he says, with the new management that's been brought in. And I'm still trying to get my mind around it, just some of the changes that we've seen here recently with Cyril Abitbol leaving, who's been the team principal there for several years. Former Suzuki MotoGP boss Davide Brivio has come in as a racing director. They got the new Alpine CEO, Laurent Rossi. And it's interesting, just the changes that they've made off the track. And some of the, I guess, the ambivalence and maybe some of the kind of blah attitude that I've had towards Renault over the past couple of seasons. I'd have to say that that's my opinion is changing around. It's obviously going to take a little bit of time for the new, you know, the new owner, well, not the new owners, but the new management regime to come in and establish their own fingerprint and their own personality upon this team. But I feel more positive about where this team is going right now. I think Ocon, I think he's a good driver. I think he still needs a ways to go. I think he's still a bit of an unpolished gem in that regards. Still a little bit on the fence about Fernando Alonso rejoining the team. You know, I think that, you know, this has the potential to be either good or bad. I think it's either going to be one or the other. I don't think it's going to be somewhere in the middle. But I think at least off the track, some of the changes that we've seen over the past month or two, I think that the team is certainly going in the right direction. And it will be interesting to see how they, you know, they handle it. Well, with the, you know, new management in place, because we know how sort of an inflammatory personality Fernando Alonso can be. If things don't start going the way that he wants or expects, how the new management will deal with that.
I hope there aren't, for the sake of Alpine, I hope the expectations aren't too great for this season. The reality mm-hmm. is I think they brought in some really great people capital, whether it's Davide Brivio or the new CEO or the new team principal. I think they brought in some really great people. That the challenge is that an F1 team is an organization of hundreds of people and thousands of ideas and millions of patents. And oftentimes the car that you're racing was in the development pipeline for years in advance. So that the reality is they're going to be able to apply very little impact to the car that we're going to see in 2021. The reality is that, and you mentioned that fingerprint, like their fingerprint will start to become obvious in 2022 and beyond. So I think we saw some flashes this year in terms of Renault's podiums, which were nice. But again, I also speak to the fact that there was an awful lot of podiums available because Ferrari had such a down year. And yeah. I don't want to attribute too much of that to Renault, but I think this is going to be that pivot year, that rebuild year. And if you've heard the comments from Alonso, I don't think he's expecting to win races, at least publicly. That's what he's proclaiming. I think 2022 is really going to be the year where we see the real Alpine, a truly leaner, more competitive Alpine. And your comment about Fernando Alonso rings true as well. And I know, and we might speak to this, but you'd kind of referenced an article with me when we were talking earlier about the fact that Ocon doesn't feel he's going to be in the shadow of Fernando Alonso. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's garbage. That, and again, I don't want to be too dramatic, but I think that's nonsense. My feeling is, having watched the sport for 20 years, 30 years, that Fernando Alonso is one of those guys that can suck all of the oxygen out of the room. And that's okay if he's winning, but I don't think for a second Ocon's going to get any shine this season unless he's successful and he's winning and he's out racing Alonso. If he's not as competitive as a 40 plus year old Alonso, he will get no shine and he will absolutely be in the shadow of Fernando Alonso. And I also think that this team wouldn't have worked so hard to bring Fernando back if they didn't intend to commit every potential resource to him to make him successful. So again, Ocon's got a slightly longer lineage with the current leadership at this team, but my sense is that if Fernando comes back and he's even remotely competitive, Ocon will be a distant second within that team in terms of priority.
Yeah, you know, I can't disagree with that. I think it's interesting, too, that their reserve driver, Sergei Sorotkin, he feels that Ocon should be able to hold his own against Fernando. But, you know, just knowing the personality that that Fernando is, and especially, you know, just the history there and just how he's dealt with, you know, situations in the past where it's become me and the other guy on the other side of the garage, you know. The things haven't always ended too rosy when there's been friction between Fernando Alonso and his teammate. And certainly when you have a young guy, Esteban Ocon, and somebody still on the up and up in Formula One, still trying to establish himself, still trying to find his feet in the sport, despite some of the things that we've seen him do with Renault and previously with Racing Point / Force India, that I don't think Fernando would take too kindly to. I don't think he'd be really warm up to that if he was shown up by, you know, his young, up and coming, yet, you know, not firmly established in the sport teammates. Excuse me. So that one, I think, is it's going to be a situation to watch, certainly, for sure. Let's move away from Alpine now. So let's talk a little bit about Ferrari. So Carlos Sainz finally is going to be able to get into the car for the very, very first time in a private test at Fiorano next week. He's been working in the simulator. There's been some pictures out there of Carlos in the car, so you know, already. And it is an interesting dynamic to see Ferrari doing very un-Ferrari things and looking at such a young lineup of Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz. And, you know, it really is, you know, like I've been saying quite a bit, you know, there's so many stories that are going to be interesting to watch. And certainly Carlos is one of those guys that that we're going to be looking to see how's he going to match up to his teammate Charles Leclerc, especially when you have the highly touted Mick Schumacher in the Haas, the Ferrari customer team, kind of ready to slide in there. And I think you were the one that first brought that up, you know, a couple of weeks back. And this is just, you know, it's a fairy tale story waiting to happen if you're Mick Schumacher, you know, because all the history that name has with Ferrari. But, you know, you got Carlos Sainz, who's going to do everything within his power to obviously keep his seat at Ferrari and shine there. So I think that it's going to be fascinating when we get to Bahrain to see how that first weekend goes and to see how these two match up. Yeah, I mean, testing and all these things and even free practice is going to be a little bit different. But I'm really, really eager to watch this dynamic in play at the Scuderia this year.
I was so struck, and I think I probably saw the same photo that you did, and it was Carlos Sainz getting a seat fitting in the Ferrari with the red Ferrari mask on. Yeah. And I was really struck. I'm just like, I don't even remember when or how this happened, but the announcement was so long ago that you almost forget it. It was distant history.
Yeah,
it was May 12th when they announced that Carlos Sainz was going to join Ferrari. We're talking 8-9 months ago. So we went through an entire F1 season with him as a part of the McLaren team, knowing that he was going to eventually make the transition to Ferrari. And now that he did, it's almost surreal to see him in Ferrari red. I'm excited, and you're right, it's going to be an extremely young driver lineup. I think at the beginning of the season, Leclerc is going to be 23. I think he turned 23 in the fall. Carlos Sainz is going to be 26, so a very young driver, average age, 24 and a half, whatever it is. But it'll be interesting. But I think, and you kind of alluded to this a couple of moments ago, the pressure is going to be on Carlos from day one. And this is a guy who he's been a reliable driver, and he scored a couple of podiums, but he's not kind of designated as an up-and-coming talent in the same way that a George Russell might be or a Charles Leclerc was. To me, he's a good fit next to Charles Leclerc in the sense that he's going to enable Charles Leclerc to do what the team expects him to do, which is win. But I also think that just in terms of the marketing potential of bringing Mick Schumacher into this team, that he has a short leash. And that short leash is only as long as Mick learning Formula One, learning the car, the grip, all those kind of things. And I don't know what it's necessarily going to take for Mick to earn that seat. I don't know what he needs to do at Haas. And to be fair, I don't know how much he can do at Haas, because I think he's going to be handicapped in that team in very much the same way that George Russell is with the Williams team.
Yeah, for sure.
But I don't know what it is he's going to need to do. But whatever it is, once Ferrari sees that from him, that transition will happen. So if I'm Carlos, it's a really tough situation, because you know you're probably never going to win out over Charles Leclerc given his legacy and his successes. And that's not to say that it can't happen and Carlos can go in this season and outperform Charles Leclerc, but I don't necessarily see that happen just because of Charles' familiarity with the engineers and the mechanics and the car and the chassis and the tires and the power unit. Like, Carlos has a lot of work to do and he doesn't have a lot of time to do it. But yeah, I'm still struck, and I wish him nothing but the best. I'm not trying to suggest he's not a talented driver, but I just think he's in a very, very stressful position. And it would be different if he had a 2-year deal or a 3-year deal. And it would be different if you didn't have Mick Schumacher suiting up for Ferrari's basically B team in Haas this coming season.
Well, you know, Mark, I think it's, you made a couple of really good points there. And I keep thinking about it. Has there been, I mean, professional sports is always the same. It's all, okay, well, you did this for me today. That's great. But what are you going to do for me tomorrow? I mean, we won today, but that's today.
Right.
You know, I mean, the memories are really, really short in pro sports, and especially in Formula One. But I mean, I can't think of another guy in recent history that has been under pressure to keep his drive before he's actually been behind the wheel on the track. I think the clock started ticking as soon as that deal was announced that Mick Schumacher was going to be driving for Haas in 2021. Just that trajectory that he's been on ever since, you know, with Formula 2 being part of the Ferrari Driver Academy, and sort of being, you know, these links they've sort of been building slowly over time with the ultimate goal to get him where, you know, that they, you know, you would think that logically would be the ideal landing place for him. So I think Carlos is under pressure, and he's in a bit of a weird spot too when it comes to like age wise. I mean, he, like you say, he's 26, so he's a little bit older than your Leclerc's, your Strolls, your Russells, and guys like that. But he's not quite as old as like your Vettels, your Perez's. He kind of sits somewhere in the middle. So he's not really so much. I mean, he's a young driver in a sense, and maybe I'm just maybe a little bit have a bit of a false impression. Just maybe that's just, you know, I've just let it slip by, over the years. But I think that, it's just a funny spot. So I think that, very much, I think we talked about it before, that I think he's coming in there, that I think he knows his position. I think very much like Bottas at Mercedes, he's not going to be the kind of guy that's going to start, having a Fernando type meltdown or start voicing, displeasure if things aren't going his way. I mean, he comes across as a very relaxed kind of very, you know, I don't want to say, I guess relaxed, kind of chill kind of guy. but you know, very much like Valtteri Bottas is, and I think that you know, I think he's there to do what he needs to do for Ferrari. But that's why I think it's going to be interesting to see what is the difference going to be between him and Charles Leclerc. I think there's going to be I don't want to say a substantial difference, but I think Charles is definitely going to have the edge.
Completely, completely, totally agree. That said, and you know, I don't mean to criticize Carlos's decision to go to Ferrari. I mean, ultimately, even if you know you're on a short leash, even if you know it's a short-term deal, to have the opportunity to drive with a historic team like this, this is something that you never turn down. I mean, the perception might be that you have a short leash, but there's nothing to say you don't go to this team and you outperform your teammate and you build a business case for you to stay there. I don't think it's going to happen. To your point, I think Charles Leclerc is going to significantly outperform him based on everything we've seen so far. And again, I'm still skeptical of Sainz's ceiling just because he is 25, he's 26, he's bounced amongst a couple of teams. And I've always wondered why it took Ferrari and now for him to get a top drive, especially considering the fact that going into this past season, going into the 2020 season, going into that contract negotiation with Ferrari, he'd scored one podium in his career. Mm-hmm. It's kind of remarkable that Ferrari would even consider that. So I think there's some strategy here beyond their expectation that he's going to win races. I think they probably believe he's just a complimentary driver to Charles Leclerc, but I wish him well. I don't think he's going to be able to perform at the same level as Charles.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to take one final break here on the show, Mark. And then when we come back, I want to talk about Carlos's predecessor, and that's Sebastian Vettel. You know, as time goes on, you know, little bits and pieces start to leak out into the media about Seb's sudden and unexpected termination from Ferrari last year. And we'll talk about that on the flip side in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be back right after this short break. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And once again, welcome to you all listening on the podcast. And those of you watching on YouTube, you can find us everywhere you listen to your podcast. We're on all good platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you can think of podcasts, we're there. And we also have the YouTube channel up and running, which we've been doing. So if YouTube's your jam, go and check us out there as well. Anyways, as I mentioned before the break, there's been some interesting little bits kind of, you know, coming to light now about Sebastian Vettel getting chopped from Ferrari just about a year ago. And, you know, it's, you know, this whole year has been kind of bizarre and surreal and obviously a difficult time to live through. But the announcement when it came that Sebastian Vettel was not coming back to Ferrari kind of came at the beginning of the whole COVID situation as it was going around the Western Hemisphere and stuff like that. We were all trying to kind of come to terms with that. And this was one of those really unexpected things at the time, because all the news that we'd been hearing, all the rumblings was, yes, Ferrari wanted back, that they're talking about it, that that a new deal seems to be imminent and something will be announced, you know, in the new future. Turned out, obviously, that, of course, it was far from that. But apparently when the news came down and Mattia Binotto, team principal, broke the news to Seb that he wasn't going to come back to Ferrari, that they didn't want him there for 2021, apparently he didn't really try to, in his own words, convince them to change their mind. He seemed to be pretty, I would say, a comfort with anything. Anyways, he told a racer, quote, "I don't need to understand Ferrari's decision, to be honest, and it doesn't change anything. I don't look at it. It doesn't. I don't work that way. It's fine for me, and I completely accept it. And when Mattia told me on the phone, it was clear. It wasn't like I was trying to fight back or convince him otherwise, not at all. I think that very much if one door shuts, another one will open. And obviously, it took a bit of time, and it raised a lot of questions about which door I want to open. It's not that I had all the teams of choice, just in terms of what I want to do more for the future, if I want to stay in Formula One or not. But obviously, I've made my decision and opened the door," end quote. So interesting. But I mean, I guess when the writing's on the wall, well, I mean, it wasn't on the wall. I mean, it was right out there in his face that Ferrari didn't want him back. I mean, what else can you say? I mean, Sebastian Vettel doesn't exactly strike me as the kind of guy that he's going to get down on his knees and beg Mattia Binotto to, you know, keep him. They'll come back for reduced salary. They'd obviously made other plans, and that was it. And Seb was obviously seemed okay with it.
Yeah, and nor should a four times world champion have to beg for a seat on a team.
Yeah.
I think what we saw last winter, last spring, was really a byproduct of a couple of things. Obviously, he made the transition over from Red Bull in 15 and 16, very much development years. 17, 18, he finished second in the driver's title, but really it was his own mistakes in a lot of ways, especially, and you alluded to this earlier when you were speaking to the Singapore situation in 2018, it was a lot of individual personal mistakes that cost him a better shot at winning those titles, especially in 2018. Mm-hmm. And then 2019, the dynamic changed because Raikkonen, who'd been a really loyal, I shouldn't say backup driver, but he'd been a very loyal beta to the alpha that was Vettel on that team, he was gone. And you introduced this fiery upstart, uber talented Charles Leclerc. And right from the beginning of the season in 2019, there was friction. There was friction off the track. There was friction on the track. There was constant discussion and noise around team orders and driver orders and Vettel disobeying and Charles Leclerc disobeying. Like, it didn't feel like that relationship was sustainable. Mm-hmm. And it was clear for a couple of reasons. One, because he was younger, but two, because he actually outperformed Vettel. It was clear that Charles Leclerc was immediately the team's future. And did you necessarily want to sign up for another 2 or 3 years of that situation as you have an aging Vettel who has certain expectations of what his role in with his team? Well, you have this emerging, blossoming superstar in Charles Leclerc. I think the one thing that was very surprising was how long it took for that news to break. Like, that's something that you would typically have heard earlier in the offseason. And even before it became official, it was widely reported. And the other challenge that kind of made the dynamic a little bit more awkward during the season was the fact that we knew in May, and we talked about this a couple of minutes ago, we knew on May 12th that Carlos was going to replace Vettel, but it was many months later that we finally found Vettel a home. So it was kind of this awkward dynamic where Ferrari had replaced Vettel, Vettel was still racing for them, it wasn't clear where he was going to be, mm-hmm. but ultimately, you know what, I still think he's a class act by any measure, but I don't think it would have been appropriate for him to beg for that seat, but I also think he realized during 2019 that the writing was on the wall that Charles Leclerc was going to be the future driver and that he wasn't going to get the treatment as an alpha driver that maybe he'd conditioned to before, and that he'd had his opportunities, right? He had 2017, he had 2018, he couldn't close in either of those seasons. That opportunity wasn't going to exist for him again.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing, I mean, you really nailed it quite accurately, was that that Charles came in and just he was immediately the it was like right off the bat proved that he was going to be the guy that that they were going to want to build this team around. But the thing is too, is that that Raikkonen, and God knows I love Kimi Raikkonen as a Formula One driver, but the thing was, I mean, for Sebastian Vettel, he was the ideal teammate because he was just never going to be able to push Seb any further. I mean, Vettel was just always that little bit quicker than Kimi Raikkonen. And then you get Charles come in and he's completely flipped the script upside down. And now not only is Vettel, trying to keep up with his teammate, but I mean, he's really having to try and match him in a big way. So I think obviously by the time that he got the phone call from Mattia, he was probably, you know, internally had known for some time, okay, well, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to stay here anymore. And then the big question is, okay, well, where do I go from here? Is another opportunity going to come up in Formula One this year? Am I going to have to sit a year out? I mean, there was even some speculation before that Aston Martin deal was announced that perhaps his time in Formula One was coming to an end. And then, you know, it's just like that old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. And, you know, it's that, that Aston Martin link never really disappeared. It didn't really build up a huge head of steam and there was a lot of hype around it. It really kind of hung around there for a while. And then I think once Perez kind of started weighing in on it and, I think that to me kind of kind of legitimized it to a certain extent that, yeah, you know, if Checo is starting to say more things about it and starting to kind of pump his own tires about what he's done to the team over the years, I think there's something here of substance about Sebastian Vettel going there. But, you know, just sticking with Vettel, he says that he actually feels richer for having raced at Ferrari. And I don't think that's necessarily a reference to his pocketbook, although I'm sure he got paid handsomely for the several years that he raced for Ferrari. But I mean, just to race of a team of that caliber, I think if you're a racing driver, I think that's got to be one of those two teams that that you want to check that box off on your bucket list to say, yeah, I drove for Ferrari in Formula One, I won races for them, or World Championship, or Mercedes. I think those are the two premier Formula One teams, two iconic marks. And you know, not only is he richer for having been there, I think he's going to bring a wealth of knowledge with him. And I think that was, you know, as we talked about the other week, that's one of the big attractions of bringing him into to Aston Martin. I mean, there's a lot of upsides to do that. So I mean, I would love to one of these days when we're able to travel again. I mean, you see these pictures of like the Ferrari Museum at Maranello. I would just love to go in there and just soak that vibe up and probably, you know, max out my credit card in the gift shop afterwards. But that certainly, I mean, the history of Ferrari, I mean, it's just synonymous with racing. It's synonymous with Formula One.
I think what's going to be very interesting to watch in the coming years and decades is how we interpret Vettel's legacy as a driver, right? Like this is a guy that won a race with Toro Rosso in 2008, ran off four straight titles with Red Bull in dominant fashion. I mean, 2012 was close with Alonso, but he ran off four straight titles in dominant fashion. And then he transitioned to the team that he saw his childhood idol, Michael Schumacher, dominate on. And he had 5 years with that team. He had two legitimate shots in 17 and 18, but he leaves never having won a title with that team, not a driver's title, not a constructor's title. And I really am curious as to how that plays into his legacy. I guess the reality is he has the opportunity to once again rewrite history and reboot his legacy with Aston Martin. So there's a lot of story left to be told, but it would have been a real shame if his career had ended after 5 years at Ferrari without a title. So
yeah,
that's really the only thoughts I have on that one.
Yeah, it certainly, I think there's a little bit more to you know, to the story. I hope for Sebastian's sake that he's able to reboot himself and reinvent himself at Aston Martin and not see what we've seen, say, latter half of 2018 and the 2019 season. 2020 was a bit of a weird year, just due to the fact how uncompetitive that car was. But I certainly, for his sake, that he's got more to say when he gets to, well, he's already had Aston Martin, but looking forward to seeing what he can do there. So finally, Mark, as we wrap it up for this week, just one final story, and we could probably go on for another 45 minutes here or more. But Sauber is set to extend their current deal with the Ferrari for another couple of years until 2025. There was some rumor out there that there might be some sort of switch to Renault, some link up with there. But I guess that this makes sense, and what with obviously the branding as Alfa Romeo. I mean, underneath it's very much a Sauber. On the outside, it's very much an Alfa Romeo. I mean, that's the whole Alfa Romeo thing is, I think it's a very fancy sponsorship deal. But still, I think it's interesting too. And I think for Ferrari, it makes sense. What with the whole new financial structure coming into Formula One, I think it makes sense to have these agreements with teams like Haas, have agreements with teams like Sauber / Alfa Romeo, because they're obviously going to have to downsize. And I think that if you can try and, if you have these sister teams, it gives you these opportunities to keep people within the system under that Ferrari umbrella. I don't know if that's necessarily going to happen, but, just from a support side, I mean, from a Ferrari point, I think there's an upside there to kind of keep your people there if it's possible. If you're, Haas or Sauber or Alfa Romeo, I think there's obviously the big upside that you you get all that support and all that knowledge. And, you know, well, I don't know if necessarily having a Ferrari power unit at the moment is a good thing, but certainly, you know, we have to think at some point that's going to get sorted out. But interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add to this is I don't know if we'll ever see the terms of this agreement, but I have to believe they're probably very favorable to Sauber. I mean, when you're in a position like you are with Ferrari right now and you're not providing your partner teams with a really competitive power unit,
yeah.
I suspect that the deal is pretty favorable. And I think you make a great point about the fact that with this pending cap crunch, teams like Ferrari and Mercedes are going to have to shed people capital like crazy to get under that cap. And I think it only makes sense that if I'm Ferrari and I can distribute some of that people capital to my partner teams in Haas and Alfa Romeo / Sauber, all the better, because ultimately I want my partner teams to be successful and I need to nurture their success because I want them to continue to buy power units from me now and in the future. So I'm curious as to what the deal is. It makes total sense. I think it probably helps to cement at least the medium term future of Sauber / and I've started to / now because I'm not confident that we'll see an Alfa Romeo team.
I know, I'm doing the same thing.
But Sauber / Alfa Romeo, it's great that we're going to see them on the grid for the next 4 or 5 years, and it just speaks to the economic stability of the sport, because it's not great for the sport to be in a position where a headline is always the financial challenges of one of the few teams that are even on the grid. So good news story all around.
Yeah. There, I just want to add one thought to that too. And, you know, I think that the new financial structure that, you know, teams have to operate in Formula One, I think it's absolutely the right thing to do, especially, well, you know, COVID and economic crunch notwithstanding, I think that, you know, the spending has been out of control for far too long. I think fiscally it's a responsible thing to do. But there's a flip side to that. I mean, we're going to see this decreasing cost cap over the next couple of years before it levels out. But I mean, the flip side, like that you said, is there going to be this loss in people capital? And I mean, not only is that detrimental to the teams themselves, but I think that it is a detriment to Formula One, that you're going to have these very, very smart people, very, very qualified people getting away from the sport. And I think that if you can keep, you know, the cream of the cream, you know, the best of the best in the sport, and maybe redistribute these people or give them options to go to other teams, I think that's a good thing for Formula One. So, you know, like I say, I mean, financial restraint is one good thing, but unfortunately there is a cost to that. And unfortunately, when it comes to cost restraints and things like that, it's usually in terms of people. So hopefully they can sort that out. Anyways, Mark, that's all I got for this week, man. I'm pretty much I'm done. I'm all set.
Hold on. Let me get my MotoGP corner notes.
Hey, there you go.
I'm joking. I have to go through the proper channels and get official sign off before I float this onto the air. But yeah, that was, I think we covered a lot of stuff in the hour 15 that we've been recording.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was just going to say though, with the impromptu and spontaneous introduction of MotoGP Corner a couple of weeks ago, and then the egregious omission of MotoGP Corner last week, you know, I know you've been chomping at the bit to get it back in there, and we'll certainly do so. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know what, I find, you know, I'm going to go on a bit of a tangent here before we sign off, that I've got so many different interests in sports that, you know, having things like a family and work and formula and all the other things I follow, that I just don't have enough time in my life to devote to all these interests. You know, I'd literally have to stay awake 20 hours a day and be financially independent, that, you know, I don't have to go out and earn a living to try and keep up with all the things I'm interested in. I know many of the people that I know, a lot of you guys are sitting there right now nodding in agreement, but hey, I guess if you're always left wanting more in life, that's a good thing. So anyways, that's it from us. Thank you again for downloading, listening to the show, and watching us on YouTube. If you want to get in touch, by all means do so. Give us an email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com or tweet us at scuderiaf1pod. And that's it. That's a wrap. Have a great rest of the week. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll be back next week. Bye for now. Ciao.